This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Lee Kravitz. He's the author of a new book called Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. Hi, Lee. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, David?
Good. So the story of this book, you know, as a kind of backdrop for anybody who hasn't heard of it yet, is that you, in your mid-50s, lost your job you actually don't refer to your specific job in the book itself, but we know from, you know, the web that you were the editor of Parade magazine at that time. And somewhat perhaps expectedly by you, your workaholic job life ended suddenly. And you were faced with a crisis that I think a lot of people have been faced with over the last few years. And maybe you could talk a little bit then about what happened next.
Yeah, my crisis was one that I think anybody who loses a job feels. First of all, you confront a maelstrom of emotions. In the beginning, what I felt was betrayed, manipulated, angry. That gave way to a sense that maybe this wasn't a bad thing, losing my job. My wife said it would be the best thing that ever happened to me. But 3 weeks later, it still didn't feel like the best thing that had ever happened to me.
Well, did you feel kind of like your self-identity was, because it wasn't your decision, it was somebody else's decision, so it kind of undermines your sense of self.
Yeah, increasingly, I understood that I'd been put my job at the center of my life from my entire career as an editor, not only at Parade, but in the 10, 15 years that had preceded Parade, and that my identity, my value, my worth in the world was tied up with the work I did. And all of a sudden, I didn't have that work. And I was left feeling empty and had a profound sense of being disconnected from the people who mattered most to me, my wife, my kids, but also the friends and, in some cases, relatives that had helped, you know, shape me when I was young. I'd fallen out of touch with a lot, if not most, of those people.
Do you feel like the arc of your work, because you were so engaged with your identity as editor or worker, that, you know, that had taken you to a different place in your being?
Well, there were a couple things. One was that when you do the work I do, most people have an element of this in their work, there's an urgency to your day-to-day deadlines, to the work you do. That becomes the most important engine of your life. And when you're being responsive to the next deadline, writing the next headline, the next meeting, the next, in my case, magazine issue, it doesn't leave room to do a lot of other stuff that isn't in that realm of activity. So I didn't have the time or energy when I was working to do much else. The other thing was, I had a great job. It was a fulfilling job. I felt that I was doing meaningful work that was having an impact on millions of readers and even the country. That was probably an overblown sense of my worth, but it was tied up in the role I had. So that even when I was home with my children and wives, I wasn't present, even in their presence. My mind was on work. And it became clear to me that before I looked for another job, before I even contemplated what I would do next in my life, I really had to do some work on myself.
Right, and then you tell this in the beginning of the book, you know, your wife said, go to Kripalu,
right,
which is a meditation center in the Berkshires, not that far from where your place is.
Right.
And, you know, you talked about that and how that, you know, I love the the idea of being rejected from there because you snore, because I'm a snorer too, so I understand that feeling.
You wouldn't do too well at Kerpalo.
No.
You couldn't live in a room with non-snorers there. We snorers are relegated to Siberia.
Well, it may have to be. Perhaps someone would be able to make a fortune building a meditation and retreat center for snorers. but in any case, this is part of your path of trying to figure out what you were going to do at that stage and how to reconcile. And then you sort of gradually came to this understanding. Well, not gradually. There seemed to have been a kind of moment of awakening, which came about when your office delivers all these boxes to your house. Which is sort of a funny idea that you were storing all of your personal papers from the past in your office. I mean, there's something kind of psychologically interesting there. Your entire life is in your office.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. And it was, the logistical reason was that my main residence is a very small apartment in Manhattan where I live with my family and all our animals. And there's not room for one box, let alone 10. But I kept my boxes from my past at work in a closet that was guarded over by my assistant. And nobody, including me, ever ventured into that place. But finally, I didn't have either a workplace or an assistant to protect and watch over my boxes. That wasn't all my assistant did.
Right. So
it was
so
one of the roles. And so when I began to go through them, was really when I began to tune myself to the process and emotions which would result in this book. Because as I went through these boxes, when you see a love letter from the past, it's pretty hard not to re-experience some of the emotions you had at age 13 or 15 or 22 when somebody who loved or thought they were in love with you writes to you. I mean, those emotions come back. And there were people who there was evidence of in those boxes who had died, for instance, grandparents, and others who I had not sufficiently told that I loved them or what they meant to me. There were moments where I ran across people who I'd lost touch with who at one point in my life were central to it. They shared my dreams. They shared whatever struggles were going on in my life at the time. When I was very poor in my late 20s, early 30s, there were people who were both there for me and who shared in that experience. And we had a profound impact on each other's lives then, and then here I am 20, 30 years later, not having any idea where they are. So all of a sudden, these emotions started taking root in my gut as I saw evidence of promises that I'd made but not kept, debts that I had undertaken and not paid back, friendships that I had let fall away, and it became clear to me that there was a lot of unfinished business in my life. That's the phrase that started to attach itself to this stuff, unfinished emotional and spiritual business. And that's when I came up with the idea of committing myself to pursuing 10 of the items that gnawed most in me. It wasn't quite that systematic because there was one situation which compelled me more than any other, and I actually went on that journey before I came up with any type of system.
This was your,
for the rest
your,
of the book.
With
my aunt Fern.
Right.
When I was going through the boxes, there was a birthday card that I saw from 1986 when I was 33 years old, and it was. And a poem was on the card, and at the end of it, a very encouraging bit of a P.S. from my Aunt Fern, who's my father's sister. And she was the aunt who I shared secrets with. She had unconditional love for me. We had a special relationship when I was growing up. She loved me dearly. I loved her dearly. She was also paranoid schizophrenic, who was institutionalized much of the time and who would get depressed periodically and try to commit suicide. Now, why this had such a big impact on me was I hadn't seen her when I was going through these boxes in 15 years prior to that moment. She'd been living with my grandmother in an apartment outside of Cleveland. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. Fern, again, was a schizophrenic. They couldn't take care of themselves, let alone each other, and they would get into fights and bruise each other. And one fight got worse than others, and the police came and took Fern away. And she was institutionalized somewhere. So 15 years later, no one in my family knew where she was, not even my father, her brother. And no one seemed to really care. They had, in their own way, rationalized reasons they shouldn't see Fern, and some of those were very understandable. They were afraid if they saw her, she would get depressed and try to commit suicide again. But it struck me that how could I let this happen? How could there be someone in the world who loved me so much and I loved them, be existing somewhere, and I don't know where they are? And I felt that I needed to find her to show her both that, to show her that I cared, or that someone cared, but also to show myself that I had that capacity for caring inside myself. And so I set off with my wife's permission and encouragement to find Fern. I did find her in a senior care facility outside of Cleveland. I didn't think I'd be able to really see her and talk with her, and if I did, her dementia, she wouldn't remember me. Or maybe I'd set off a string of bad reactions. But in any case, I asked the social worker if I could see her, and she said, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't. And she also told me no one at all had seen her in 14 years. No one from my family, and only one person outside of my family had even visited her. Imagine that, 14 years. So the nurse wheels her out of the dining hall, wheels this woman who looks vaguely familiar, and I expect her not to acknowledge me in any way, but as the wheelchair approaches me, a voice shouts out, Lee Richard Kravitz, my brilliant nephew. Lee Richard Kravitz is here. Everyone, Lee Richard Kravitz is here to see me. So she shouts it to the rest of the patients there, most of whom had Alzheimer's. And my aunt Fern, she was maybe 67 at the time. And I saw her, and she says, give me a hug. Hug me, Lee Richard. And I hugged her, and the hug went on for so long. It went on for, it seemed, 10 minutes or more, and it was the deepest, most profound hug that I'd ever in my life experienced. And then I felt the weight of the world drop from my shoulders. Really, it was like a weight falling from it. I just felt so much lighter as this weight fell off my shoulders. It was the weight of all the guilt that I felt not having seen Fern, and it was also a positive lightness that came from feeling that sort of sensitivity and empathy which had marked our relationship throughout my younger years. And at that point, I knew the power of pursuing your unfinished business. And then I decided, after I'd seen Fern, that I would try to make amends and close circles in other parts of my life.
Well, and so you, and of course, probably can't cover all of this in this short interview, but
sure.
You talked to, you worked on reconciling relationships in your family that had been broken for years. you went back and found old friends. Mm-hmm. You found an old your favorite teacher, which I thought was a very powerful chapter. You know, it was, and of course, I guess I think sort of emotionally, it's hard not to feel that the reconciliation, the finding of Fern, is really the key, as you just described it. It's really the key for everything.
And yet, you mentioned the teacher, for instance. There was a teacher who was the most important, influential adult in my teenage years when I was troubled. He'd seen something in me and encouraged me to write. He was a philosophy teacher, and he exposed me to the greatest books ever written and the greatest minds. We read everything from the New Testament to Camus and Buber and Sartre. And yet, when I left high school, I didn't thank him, nor did I keep in touch with him, even as I became somewhat successful in my life. And at the heart of every type of unfinished business I was to discover is some sort of fear. And as I analyzed why I hadn't seen Tony Jarvis, my teacher, or thanked him, it was because I was afraid in some way. Well, first of all, I knew other students would come and be his pet students. And also, I feared that no matter how successful I became, I would never live up to the promise he saw in me. So as a result, year after year went by, and here I was at age 54, 55, feeling a need to talk with him again, probably because I needed some encouragement at that stage. I just lost my job. It would be nice to get a little encouragement from him. He'd given it to me once before when I was feeling empty, but also because we always used to talk about the search for meaning in his class. We used to converse about God and what's God like. Why are we here on earth? And I had a need at age 54 to once again be talking about those things, because I had put my spiritual life in exploration on hold all those years that I was working so hard. And so I sought him out. He had been the headmaster and a very famous headmaster of a school, Roxbury Latin, in Boston. And he'd retired from that. When he taught me, he was 29 years old. Now he was approaching 70. I hadn't seen him in all that time. And seeing him again was wonderful. We resumed the conversation we had when I was 17 and talked for 3 days about the purpose of existence, meaning in the world. And it was so wonderful for me to talk seriously with the person who has set me on a certain serious path in my life.
Well, you know, it's interesting that I think thinking about all of the experiences you had when you went back and talked to people,
yeah.
You know, there is that sense that you were able to pick right up and participate, you know, and I think many people have shared that when they, you know, re-find someone from their past. Yeah, I hear this, and I've certainly experienced it myself, you know, that you really feel like the years just fell away and you're back where you were. But in other cases, you know, you meet people and years have gone by and it's a completely different person. That the moment when you were connected was really based on who you both were at that time, and then you've changed, they've changed, it no longer made sense. But in all of the cases, I think in all of the people that you talked to, you really did reconnect in a pretty powerful and deep way, and it may be partly because you were open. And also that you were seeking in an active way, you know, whether it's to make amends or whether it's to fulfill the promise that was made in the past. That was an ongoing part element. It wasn't just that you accidentally met somebody. You really sought them out.
Right. It wasn't that I ran into them at a reunion or saw them on the street. And there was a lot of thought and feeling that went into the encounter long before I re-encountered them. And you hit it with that word, open. when you approach someone with an open heart, totally sincerely, and yet at the same time not expecting to get anything from that encounter other than what it will give you, somehow it helps to open the other person up. So I think I think partly because I went in with a certain attitude, it helped. I didn't have as much resistance as I've heard other people have when they've written a letter or tried to contact someone they've wanted to make amends to.
Also it may be that, you know, maybe there's this sense of, I don't want to say half-heartedness, but I think there is a way of approaching someone from the past. You know, I there's a book, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but written by a guy named Paul Slansky, which is a collection of apologies, lame, horrible apologies from public figures over the last 30 years. The world has become adept at apologizing without really meaning it.
Yeah.
And I think that what you what you're talking about is, you know, when you approach someone, this idea of making amends or reconnecting in order to finish unfinished business, you have to really mean it in a deep way. And you can't use the words that somehow get you off the hook when you approach someone, because they can tell right away that you may be sincere, but you don't mean it.
Right. You don't just kind of mouth words. When I approach, even writing a letter or an email to see someone after all those years, I think they felt that this meeting would be something of utmost importance to me, and that I was truly, because I was truly interested in who they were, what they'd become in their lives, the path that they had took, and the perspective we could bring to each other on our lives. So I came, you know, totally open and raw, but also, you know, people like to feel that others are interested in them.
Right. I think that's right. It's not just about the person who's contacting you and their issues. It's about both of you.
Yeah, it's about the other person. And I also found that the positive impact wasn't only on me of these reconnections. It was on the other person as well. That was one of the big lessons of this. In journey after journey and encounter after encounter, I wasn't the only one who was transformed or who grew or who came away with a sense of peace and inspiration. The other person did too. It might have not have been for exactly the same reason, but I think they got something profound out of the experience as well.
Well, I think that's an important thing. Well, it seems like, you know, I've looked at your website, which is called myunfinishedbusiness.com, and it seems like, you know, you're now, you know, maybe taking up this idea of reconnection as a kind of active role for yourself. Are you being approached by people who have responded to your book and are kind of using it as a jumping off point for themselves?
Well, it's been interesting. I've gotten a number of letters from priests, rabbis who have found value in the book, and also everyday people like you and me who are sharing their stories with me. I invite people to share their stories of how they went about their unfinished business and the impact it had on them and the people they encountered on the website. I'm going to share those stories with people who come to the website. I also have a toolkit which helps people go about completing their unfinished business, face their fears, make amends, reflect on the experience, write in journals. That's on myunfinishedbusiness.com on the website. I'm not a self-help expert. I don't even believe in that sort of thing. I think that transformation comes from within, not by any paint-by-number prescriptions. But I did go through a year using some strategies that worked for me that I share with anybody who comes to the site who may feel a need to close circles and make amends in their lives.
Well, it's hard to imagine that
any of us in the modern world. And I thought about this a little bit, that, you know, the difference between today and perhaps 100 years ago, aside from the fact that we, you know, we are living in this post-industrial world where everybody works way too much, but that because of the fragmentation of the society, people don't live near their families. They don't live in the same places where they grew up. If you grow up in a small town and you stay there your whole life, your unfinished business is less likely to be as profound and difficult as it is for, you know, a modern kind of transitory member of the, you know, the workforce who work will force you to travel, or this migratory sense that we all have where we never end up living where we grew up. So
I think you're absolutely right. We do not live, for the most part, in the same place where we were born and raised. And our families, I have three brothers, and they're all in different cities, and my parents live in another city. By definition, we're fragmented as a family. It takes work to get back together to be a family again. And we don't do that work for the most part. We just don't do it. It's too hard because we each have our lives and our children and our urgencies and priorities. And that leaves a lot of unfinished business because, of course, our families are the institution that shaped us most deeply. And so a lot of that unfinished business, unless you really make an effort to pursue it, can go unresolved to the detriment of your own life.
Right.
You don't want to pass on that legacy to your children.
No, I agree. I think that's an important lesson as perhaps a corrective, you know, and maybe the kids are going to get that, you know, that they don't need to make the same mistakes that their parents made.
I've interestingly gotten letters from all my youngest nephews. They're 18, 19, 20, and they very deeply want to have relationships with their cousins. And they read the book, and they're filled with sadness. How can we not become the people, you, meaning me, the writer, and my brothers or my parents and their brothers and sisters were? How can we be friends and close to our cousins and not hold grudges for 30 years and not be unknown to them? So I've been really pleased to get these letters from the youngest in my family, because I think they don't want to make the same mistakes. They want to stay connected.
Right.
And the other message of this book in the end is, don't put off until tomorrow what you can do today.
Well, I think that's a good lesson. Listen, Lee, it's been great talking to you. I really enjoyed this conversation. We've been talking, this is Writer's Cast. I'm David Wilk. We've been talking to Lee Kravitz, the author of Unfinished Business, One Man's Extraordinary Year of Trying to Do the Right Things. Hope you'll go find it. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, David.